Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here, busting myths, taking names. And we got a couple of really big ones to bust on this show. But more importantly, we also have myths that are backed up by individual stories and, of course, great historical research. And the great historian who's done that historical research is named Dr. Melissa Ford, and her book is called A Brick and a Bible, Black Women's Radical Activism in the Midwest During the Great Depression. Dr. Ford, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
You know, we talk a lot about the Depression on the show. We haven't done a Depression show probably in a year or two, but it's such a huge topic in American history. And of course, it has spawned many, many myths. But one of the things, one of the focuses of your book is you show that a lot of Black women, like a lot of Black people, leave the South during the Great Depression and move north.
Right.
Could you tell Buzzkillers a little bit about that process in general, why it happened, why the Depression hit the South particularly badly, why people thought they had to leave?
Thank you for that question. It's so great because we often think of the Great Depression and we either think, you know, Dust Bowl or unemployed people in Chicago, right? But the South was particularly hard hit, especially when you're talking about a region that is still transforming from rural and agricultural to this more urban industry early in the 20th century. But if we're looking at Black women, we're looking at women who were employed majority as domestic workers or agricultural workers. And those are the first to like be let go. And so when you're talking about women and Black women, we're seeing huge unemployment populations just everywhere in states like Alabama. And so then when opportunities open to migrate north, we're seeing almost like entire communities move through these networks of the Great Migration. So in Alabama in particular, neighborhoods of African Americans ended up in Cleveland. So Cleveland became this like mecca for Black migrants from Alabama. And so it's called chain migration. You know, one family moves or a family member moves and then sends back for the other family members. And so we see that throughout the industrial north in Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, and St. Louis. Those are the cities I study, but that's kind of the story throughout the country at this time of the Great Migration.
Yeah, I think people forget that, you know, in the Depression, again, as you say, farmers and agricultural laborers in particular get hurt the worst. We think again of all these factory workers thrown out of work, but it's that's not the case. The single farmers and the agricultural laborers suffer the worst.
Yeah, and if you look at unions, if you want to fall back on unions in the 1930s in the South, there's no unions protection. There's very little, let's just say, and not for Black workers.
So do you mind summarizing just a few sentences, all the different reasons why they leave the South?
So economic reasons are huge, of course, and pursuit of jobs, able to provide for your family, essential aspects of survival. But we can't discount the pervasive racism in the South that is very blatant. And that's the word that they'll often use, is this racism that they see and encounter physically, daily, all the time. And so there's definitely that sense of surely there's got to be something better. And so we do see 3 million African Americans during this few decades leave, and all of them, you know, for different reasons, but economics, relief of this pervasive and violent racism, and opportunities and hope. Ultimately, there's hope of something better. And so that's why they often call the North the promised land. All these ideas kind of wrapped up in that the North is the savior.
Right. Well, let's talk about that North as a savior thing and the North as a promised land, because that's the way it's often even today portrayed in textbooks, you know, that people come, African-Americans come North because it is much better, both economically and socially, in terms of less racism. But we know, and your book confirms an awful lot of that. A lot of that is myth.
Absolutely. And that's a narrative that goes back to the Civil War and before the Civil War, right? The abolitionist North were the good guys. I mean, everything was fine in the North. I mean, let alone their race riots and lynchings happening as North as Chicago and New York. So when we're talking about these families, these women, these neighborhoods, these communities who are moving north, picking up their entire lives and ending up in places like Cleveland, it's very quickly revealed that these cities are not that promised land. There's little work for Black women specifically in these northern cities, pervasive segregation in housing and education. We have racially restrictive covenants, we have redlining, we have all these prohibitive housing policies that place African Americans in the oldest and most ill-kept housing in the city. And so that's the story. It's almost copy-paste of the story in Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, and St. Louis. There are Black neighborhoods that are economically in economic decline because their city has reinforce these racist housing practices. Education is suffering in these because we have this lower tax income. And so just these piles and piles of evidence for these workers, these Black migrants, that this northern city, this promised land, is no different. And in fact, I have letters from women saying, like, this is just as bad as the hellhole in Alabama. And the racism looks different, right? It's not the KKK burning a cross in their front yard. It's, I can't get a job because no one will hire me as a Black woman. It's, I can't send my kid to a quality school because they won't let me buy a house in this neighborhood. And so this is all, of course, exacerbated by the Great Depression and the fact that, you know, in the early years in 1932, some cases to cities like Detroit, 50% of the Black population was out of work. And so it's Black working class that's hit particularly hard and in these cities in a way that's just breaks all those notions of that promised land.
Well, the book talks about how women react to this, African American women react to this, and especially how they eventually start to contact the Communist Party. But how do they react at first? My guess is they don't jump to the Communist Party as the first venue of relief. Do they try other things first?
Absolutely. I mean, communists is not your first go-to for many reasons, but mostly because Black women didn't know about the Communist Party. They hadn't been a priority for the Communist Party if we're looking around right around 1930s. Let's say you have a Black family that's migrating to Detroit. They come to the city and they go to the places that they're familiar with, the institutions they're familiar with in the South, and that's the church. And the church will likely set them up with a job. If they can, the church will provide a community. But the church is very limited in terms of its economic abilities. And so in Detroit in particular, churches had been traditionally aligned with Henry Ford. Basically, Henry Ford was donating money to the churches, and the Black churches would send him workers. Now, when the Great Depression hits, who are the first people Henry Ford and the automobile industry are laying off? It's the Black workers. And so those traditional avenues, that religious community, can't help the tens of thousands of Black workers who are unemployed. In fact, we're at hundreds of thousands of Black workers in Detroit right around 1932. And so we have other organizations in place, the Urban League, the NAACP, but all of these institutions are weakened by the Great Depression, and all of them really stress this kind of liberal mindedness of if you work hard and you get your job, you can depend on the government, the democratic process will work, just be a good citizen, and those types of ideas. But when the Communist Party comes in and says, no, the system is broken, there's a real appeal.
And so is that then what happens? Do they hear about it through leaflets? Do they hear about it through posters, through gossip among social groups? How does it is the Communist Party out there beating the drum on the street corners, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes, and almost quite literally, if you look at places in Chicago, they are holding almost nightly meetings in parks in Black neighborhoods. They have speakers who are usually white men, white women who are, you know, talking about Marx and talking about these big political theories, but they're also saying, hey, the reason you can't get a job, the reason why you're starving, right? These are things that the Communist Party addresses. These are what they would call the bread and butter issues. So, for example, in Chicago, most famously in 1932, there was one of these meetings going on in a Black neighborhood. There's a rally, and everyone's, you know, on board. Yes, the system is broken. Yes, we need to do something. The government has to be held accountable, things like that. And there's a story going around in the crowd that there's down the street, an elderly woman is being evicted from her home. She couldn't pay her rent. And so her landlord is evicting her. And she's a 70-year-old woman who's going to be out on the street. People are incensed and they march to the home, right? And so this is You can absolutely see this is how someone would just get caught up in the crowd or be walking by and be like, huh, what's going on? And this is that presence that the Communist Party begins to facilitate in Black neighborhoods throughout the Midwest. And so in this particular case, what we have is a riot erupts. The Red Squad, or the police unit that was there to suppress radicalism in Chicago, was particularly violent, opened fire, bricks, missiles were thrown, and two men were killed in this riot. And so the Communist Party was able to use events like that. And it wasn't just in Chicago where we have riots and people injured and killed. Same thing again across the Midwest. The Communist Party was able to use those as a kind of like a hook to get Black workers interested. And so, yeah, it's something you come across just on the street.
So do people see, I mean, one of the things about the Communist Party of the United States of America, which is its full title, CPUSA, is that they argue that, look, this Great Depression explains everything that's wrong about capitalism and American society. It's not just a depression for a segment of the economy. It's not just a depression for a type of worker or anything like that. It's nothing we've seen before, nothing like 1893 or any of the other panics before. It's comprehensive because the capitalist system is comprehensive in how it's built up these inequalities that will lead to this eventually. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is, does the Communist Party then present, and I think they're sincere about it, present to people, this is one-stop shopping. There's a one-stop shopping explanation for why this Great Depression is happened, and there's a one-stop shopping explanation for the way it can be fixed, the only way it can be fixed.
I think that's a great way to think about the solution the Communist Party is offering, right? It's working class solidarity, it's mobilization of the masses, it's unionization. These are that one stop solution. And for many African Americans joining the party, that worked. But for the one that joined the party, there's like 1,000 that didn't. However, they are still in the rallies. They are still at the protests, that they're still at the meetings, and they're often on the periphery of the party, but still very much using the same kind of like anti-capitalist rhetoric, using the same type of racial solidarity ideas. And so it's always hard to like look at the influence of the Communist Party during this time. It's because not everyone is going to join the Communist Party. However, these ideals of solidarity and working class mobilization had always been present within the working class. It's just the Communist Party tapped into that in a very specific time and place.
Now, does the Communist Party also stress race more than they would have to other audiences? It might seem obvious that they would do that, but then maybe it wasn't. Maybe the argument is that we're all brothers under the skin and so forth. So the fact that we're preaching and we're having events in an African American neighborhood doesn't necessarily mean that we're just about race.
Right, and that's where you get into some real ideological debates, which I try not to focus on too much, because ultimately that's what not the working class was not super concerned with those ideological debates at this time. And in fact, there's this one quote after an eviction riot in Cleveland from the newspaper that said, "These workers know little of Marx, care little about Russia, but they know when they're starving." And I think that's the of it. Like, yes, there are these ideological debates of going on, like, where does race stand in relation to class? And then, of course, there's the woman question. Where does gender study? Like, what's the hierarchy? How do you embrace this? Who do you sell this to? Those are real philosophical arguments that have real effects. But for a working class woman in 1932 in Cleveland who's trying to feed her family, that doesn't matter to her. What she hears is, the government's got to do something, and the Communist Party is here to force their hand.
Yeah, everything's been pushed to a certain point.
Right. That sounds great. And there's no one else.
Yeah, it's not as if, the Democratic Party is
No.
beating the drum in certain parts of these cities. Well, how successful in general, before we get onto the case studies, which we're going to do after the break, how successful in general was the party in getting not only members, but as you say, this whole peripheral group?
That's such a great question, and one of those mysteries of history we'll never quite pin down.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think I would say very successful. I would say when the majority of the Black working class knows about the Communist Party and knows about what they've been doing in these Black working class neighborhoods, that this is a party that has succeeded at its goals. And one way they did that was through the unemployed councils, which was there to organize unemployed workers. And so they weren't technically communist, but they were made up of communists. And so having this organization that wasn't technically communist, but was saying similar things, really helped bring people in these Black communities closer to, if not into, the Communist Party. So I don't think it, I think if they've been underestimated for sure, the influence of the communists.
Yeah, that's very interesting because, again, as you implied earlier, and as I think a lot of us, when we talk about the Great Depression in our classes, we say things are so bad that people literally don't have time to think about larger issues or joining other parties, but clearly they do.
Absolutely. It's inspiring that, in the face of your family starving, you choose to march with, 10 or 3,000 other people. Because today I'm not sure what our course of action would look like. And I think in 2020, we were grasping for what that looked like when we did have massive unemployment and racial injustice and trying to figure out what that means for the working class today. But they had it figured out in the 30s.
And they were certainly adept at getting their message across. After all, this is by world standards, this is coming to the United States somewhat late. Is that right?
Communism?
Yeah,
Yes.
the Communist Party and that sort of thing.
Yes, relatively later. Yeah.
Well, this is a good time for us to take a little sponsorship break to appease the capitalists who actually are my corporate overlords. So
All hands.
we'll do that now, and we'll be back with Dr. Ford in just a moment. Okay, Buzzkillers, we are back with Dr. Melissa Ford, who's talking to us about her great book, A Brick and a Bible: Black Women's Radical Activism in the Midwest During the Great Depression. Before the break, Dr. Ford, you laid out very clearly the sort of groundwork of what was going on at the time. Not only the Great Depression, but its effects on the South, its effects on African Americans in general, its effects in northern urban areas, dispelled some very big myths about the Great Depression, and talked a little bit about how the Communist Party was able to attract attention from African Americans in these urban areas. Do you mind if you give us some really good sort of case studies that help to explain what happened? I mean, these stories of individual people that you talk about so well in the book, that I think the listeners would love to hear their stories.
Absolutely. And that's ultimately why I study history, why I write history, is for those stories. And the first one I think of, and you're probably wondering, is the title, A Brick and a Bible. And that's one of my favorites. They're all my favorites. But this is a story of Carrie Smith. She lived in St. Louis in 1933. She was actually from Mississippi, so she was part of this great migration. I mean, she's a middle-aged woman. She's kind of like your typical middle-aged woman, Black woman living in the Midwest. She goes to church every Sunday. She's active in her community. She's worked at the same place for over 16 years, and that's a nut picking fact. And so Carrie Smith has worked at a nut picking factory and has, shown herself to be a veteran employee. But when the Great Depression hits, she's seen her weekly wages plummet. She sees working conditions deteriorate, and she's seen white women be promoted and be treated better than her consistently. And so when communists in St. Louis come to her and essentially say, "Hey, we think you and the other Black women could organize into a union," she's like, "Sign me up." And so Carrie Smith becomes the leader of this strike in 1933 called the Funston Nutpicker Strike. Just again, just kind of this average Black woman who's just living her life until the Great Depression strikes and the communists offer this opportunity. And so there's this one moment when she is, the day before the strike is settled, the strike goes on for 2 weeks, but the day before the strike is settled, she's leading everybody into a protest march on City Hall. And so she's on the steps of City Hall, and she has always been very vocal, and she like leads the protesters in songs, and she has Bible verses. So she's got a Bible in one hand, and in her other hand, she has a brick. The brick has been used here for self-defense. The women have been facing violence and attacks on the picket lines. So she has a Bible in one hand, a brick in the other. And she says, "Girls, if we stick together, we cannot lose." And so I was just really struck by this image because here is someone, 10 years ago who had never thought of herself as a labor leader. But she comes as this extraordinary labor leader. Even the communists in their internal documents are like, she is great. We love Carrie Smith. And there's another woman, Cora Lewis, who is also equally as passionate, but Carrie really emerges as the heart. And the fact that she brings a Bible, right? You wouldn't think a communist protest would have a Bible. But I think that's the important part, is as these Black workers were associating with the communists or joining the Communist Party, they were still doing so with their history, their legacy, their heritage, that often included, the Black church, or included ideas about Black activism, or included ideas about the Black family. And those are things that the Communist Party really didn't touch. And so there's something that was still undeniably Carrie Smith about her activism, but there was also something very communist about it. And so that's why I play with this term Midwestern Black radicalism, which shows that, these African-Americans are rebelling in radical ways that are familiar to the Communist Party, but doing so in a way that is very specific to them as Midwesterners in the Great Depression.
How successful is she? How does she go along and try to get these things done, and what happens?
They win. It's one of those great stories. This is why it's fun to write about, because they win. The Communist Party is ecstatic. They tout Black women in St. Louis as the vanguard of the party. There's a strike that takes place in Chicago just a few weeks later, where it was Black women on Chicago's South Side who were striking in an apron making factory. So almost the exact same scenario. And that's one of the reasons why I study this, is because we have this almost direct comparison. But in Chicago, they're holding signs and chanting, "Do as the nutpickers did." And guess what? In Chicago, they win. And so these are remarkable moments of labor victory before we have huge New Deal legislation, before we have the Congress of Industrial Organizations, before we have Black working class unions for women in 1933. And so these huge moments that are, yes, because of the Communist Party, but also extremely there because of these amazing women like Carrie Smith and Cora Lewis and others whose names have been lost, unfortunately, to history. Mm-hmm. Now, the sad story is, if you know your labor history, you know that a lot of the labor protections were rolled back. And so by the late 1930s, we actually see a lot of these industries in Chicago and St. Louis that employ Black women leave. They move to the South, where unionizing is less likely. And often the women will go back to domestic service jobs, will be unemployed. And so it's a story of sad story. But out of that, those moments of unrest, and out of this, what is supposedly a dark, dull, depressing time, is where we see the seeds planted for the civil rights movement, Black Power movement, and Black Lives Matter today.
Well, that's just an amazing story. And the fact that Communist Party officials are writing about her, talking about her in their correspondence, in their sort of, party organization and strategizing is fabulous. So please give us another story of another great person.
All right. So this was a story of a woman who's adjacent. So Carrie Smith does join the Communist Party. She goes on to be a labor leader. She kind of disappears from party records, unfortunately. But a woman who is kind of adjacent to the party is Rose Billups. She is married to Joseph Billups, who is a Black worker in the Ford Motor Company. And so he's a member of the Communist Party. He's card-carrying communist. He's out there giving speeches daily. And he's been arrested a lot. He's been fired a lot. And so here is this poor woman, Rose. She's supporting her husband, who can't keep a job because he's a radical. And she's a hat maker. She's a milliner. So she makes hats for a living. And so she can't join the Communist Party because then she'll be fired. So she's got to kind of hold down the fort. And while her husband's, trying to organize automobile workers, trying to get the union together, she's out there fundraising. She is out there doing soup kitchens. There's a story where she talks about how she went to the butchers and the farmers and got beans and whatever she could. And they would throw them all in a pot and everybody would come and help themselves. And then her husband says something like this. She wasn't that good at it, but everybody ate it anyway. And it's like, really, Joseph? Really? And so Rose is adjacent to the party. She is fundraising, like I said, and she's providing these, she's feeding the men during strikes. as the era goes on and as the organizing in the automobile industry continues, we'll see that she begins the Women's Auxiliary in Detroit, meaning that the women of the automobile workers found their own organization to help promote the union. And guess what? Without the women, the men wouldn't join the union. And so Rose here is indirectly driving union membership because she's getting these wives to convince their husbands. And she's doing so in secret. She's risking her reputation and all of this while still married to a black communist. And she's black herself, of course. So there's a real moment of her just working on the sidelines, but this work being possible because the time and the place and because the Communist Party has made these inroads. And I think the hardest part about this was that I was reading an interview in the 70s with her and her husband, and this interviewer was very much interested in black workers in Ford Motor Company. And so saying, okay, Joseph, tell me about how you organize. Tell me about the black workers. Tell me about cars and all that stuff. And at one point, Rose just goes, excuse me, can I talk about how the women organized Ford? And the interviewer's like, okay, sure. Gives her a minute and then goes back to her husband. And so that's the story. Like these women's stories have been erased. They have not been prioritized by historians or activists. And so I sense, see, my role is to amplify them, to bring Rose's story to as great of importance to that of her husband's, to bring Carrie Smith that to that of the communist leaders, right? Because these moments, whether in Detroit or Chicago, St. Louis, or wherever they are in the country, are planting these seeds that will eventually give fruit to civil rights movements we can recognize, and then even more radical movements that we see today.
Well, let me ask you that then, as a sort of a wrap-up topic. As an historian, you're out, and I happen to know this because, of course, I read the book. But you're out there reading. You're out there finding brand new material, right? Stuff that had not been analyzed or read by other historians, or sociologists, or anything, or economists even. What was that like? First of all, trying to find the archival stuff, and then the discoveries you made as you made them. What was that like? I mean, so I've been so pleased that our listeners love to hear these stories. Most of our listeners are not historians, but they love this feeling of discovery and this feeling of newness and actual changing the way we think about things.
Oh, I love the discovery. So when I was reading that interview where Rose interrupts and she's like, "Can I talk for a minute, please?" It was like a light shone on me at this library in the middle of Wayne State University archives. Because yeah, those are my beautiful moments of discovery, and I love being able to share and amplify those. But it was really hard. There are a lot of gaps. I went to Detroit because I was looking for this. I was looking for a photo. Apparently, during the middle of a march, a man was shot, and a white communist was shot, and he was bleeding from the neck. And so, a black woman named Maddie Woodson, she was a communist, and she's like, "I have to help my comrade." So she tears a piece of fabric from her skirt and uses it to stop the blood on his neck. And apparently, there's a photograph of that. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I have to have this." But it's not. It doesn't exist. I can't find it. And so that goes to the same kind of refrain of Rose's story. Like these stories of these black women running in these radical circles have not been as prioritized as the white men or the black men. And so it was really difficult to kind of to piece through and find some of these stories because you have, communist archives, you have mainstream black newspaper archives, but you don't often have the voices of the women themselves. So it's almost like a triangulation, trying to figure out how I can get closest to the truth. I'll never have those words of Maddie Woodson saying, "I leaned down and I knew I was doing this for the glory of the working class." I don't have that. But I do have, surveillance records by the FBI. I do have information that she ran for office as a communist. I have, the US Census. And so it's a lot of puzzle work and trying to be able to tell what I hope is a genuine story, because we'll never be able to tell the 100% truth.
Yeah, but you go to Wayne State to the archives there looking for this photograph, but then you end up finding this interview where Rose has to insert herself and remind the interviewer that, the women were more important. Was that accidental, or did you know that there was, was there a sort of a catalog description of this? There's this interview also, blah, 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 blah.
No, and that's the thing. In so many of these archives, it was Black workers or Communist Party. It was never Black women in the Communist Party. So I had to check all of these archives. So, yes, so I was in labor archives in Detroit. I was in Urban League archives in St. Louis. I was in radical labor organ archives in New York. And then I was in Cleveland. I was all over the place in the Midwest, trying to piece these things together. And so, yeah, it was a lot of staring at microfilm, lot of reading newspaper articles, trying to catch a glimpse of a name or a location that I recognized. And ultimately, I'm very happy with some of the stories that I was able to tell.
Yeah, and we need to remind the Buzzkillers, not everything is digitized. In fact, for historians, almost nothing is digitized. And the last thing they're going to get around to digitizing is the archives that relate to everyday people.
Exactly. And when you talk about marginalized communities like Black women workers, it's especially difficult because sometimes those records aren't even there. I will say, though, that it's gotten better, and it's just within like the past 5 years, things I used to have to go to New York for are now online. So it's exciting as a historian to see these more radical archives being prioritized. Then we can have better access, and historians can have better access to these stories. And so I'm really hopeful and excited about the next kind of generation of scholarship that will come out about women in the Midwest, because it's evolving, right? If you say Black Midwest, people laugh, right? That's not a thing. No one studies that. Well, we are. And there's a lot of really important stories to be told and shared.
Oh, absolutely. And what we want to right here and now,
Exactly.
shout out to young undergrads who are wondering whether they should go on to graduate school. Look, there are all these fantastic topics out there. There are all these fantastic unexplored areas. Stuff to literally Indiana Jones style find something.
Yes.
Well, maybe not Indiana Jones style. Please do it more
Yeah,
respectfully
more respectful.
than Indiana Jones. But you know what I mean? You're literally unearthing information that hasn't been seen since it was written in the 30s. So there's tons of opportunity.
Absolutely. It's so rewarding. It's hard to believe it's a job sometimes.
Well, keep that quiet. You are a worker. We don't want people to exploit you once they've heard that. It just remains for me to thank you, Dr. Ford, so much for coming on the show. This has really been very enlightening for me, and I know it'll be very enlightening for our listeners.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. I love talking about these women. So thank you.
Yeah, well, Buzzkillers, as you know, A Brick and a Bible is on the Buzzkill bookshelf. It's there for you to get because it is absolutely gripping reading. Please do so. Please go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and do all the things you need to do there. Sign up for the newsletter, rate and review us on your podcast platforms, and tell all your friends about the show. And Dr. Ford, please tell your friends and your students about the
I'll
show.
make them listen to it. Extra credit.
Good, good, good. Oh, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. So, Buzzkillers, we will talk to all of you out there next week.